Former journalist with the Racine Journal-Times, who currently serves as an adjunct instructor at UW Parkside, and Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College. Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
This is Len Iaquinta for Community Matters. Our topic today is the new media partnership covering Racine and Kenosha. We'll hear from a recent guest, Denise Lockwood, publisher of the Racine County Eye. Joining her is Daniel Thompson, publisher of the Kenosha Lens and the Kenosha Uptown Observer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Mr. Thompson, you know, yes. I entered into Google a few hours ago the two words Kenosha journalist, and your article in Mother Jones comes up at the top of the list, complete with your picture. Top of the list. I know most of our listeners know a bit of the story. Maybe they've heard you on Facebook or heard you on YouTube. But please tell us in your own words about your journey over the past almost exactly nearly 6 weeks.
Okay. So at the beginning of the story, people know pretty well. I went to an event that was for the Jacob Blake family, and it was peaceful. It was kind of a march and rally. So it was we met at, I think, Mr. Owen's Barbershop and marched to Civic Center Park, which is like the official protest spot in Kenosha now. And during that, there were many speakers talking about, you know, change, progress. And even Mr. Blake's father was calling for peace, you know, an end to rioting. But within that was a speaker that said the words, if they kill one of ours, it's time to kill one of theirs, I believe was the direct quote, which is what my former former paper decided to go with as a headline. And I disagreed, and I immediately let my boss, Bob Heiss, know that. And in a conversation that spanned about 20 minutes, I resigned. Following that, everything kind of went insane for me, because first I talked to the New York Times about it, and then I talked to Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which Rory Linane did a really good job on the story that she wrote in the Journal
Sentinel.
That
was an excellent piece of work. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was.
I loved that story so much. It's bookmarked in my browser, actually. But things started to happen, and, you know, there's a lot of attention. And then you kind of saw my head get big and for a few weeks, and then you've seen me kind of shrink back down the past couple weeks. So I've been, at one point, my Twitter impressions were over 2 million. I could reach over 2 million people on Twitter. So that was insane. So everything built up to such a point that it's almost like you're not a real person anymore. Daniel Thompson, the person, and Daniel Thompson, this journalist with integrity, were two different sides of one coin, but very much the person was being neglected through all of it. So it's been a long process, but in the end, you know, through it, I've partnered with Denise, and I've started writing again, and, you know, starting to move the ball forward on not only the Uptown Observer, but also Kenosha Lens, and kind of developing that network that I had in print journalism, but more on the independent side. Because honestly, from a lot of conversations I've had over the past month with community members, with Denise, with anybody, it's that there is so much opportunity outside of corporate print journalism that I personally wasn't aware of, because I've only been in print journalism, and that's been for eight years now. But it's been, I don't know, the world went insane and now I'm here. That's kind of how I think of it at this point. I think what was surreal was getting recognized in public sometimes, even in Racine, which Denise was there for one of them. I was recognized by a jogger whose husband actually worked apparently for Channel 6, and they expressed their appreciation for what I did. So it's been quite an experience. I would not recommend instant temporary fame at all. Please avoid it at all costs. But it offered me an opportunity to get to know so many people and to kind of transition into a new life, a life that I like better. So it's been a wild ride, but now I'm just back I'm Daniel. I'm a journalist, and I work in Kenosha.
Just plain Dan. So it reminds me of the old soap opera. Just plain Dan. Well, I don't know that you'll ever be just plain Dan, Daniel. But as you look back over the last 6 weeks, I can understand the feeling that you almost feel at some point. I think I would feel almost outside of myself when seeing the media publicity and hype. And I do want to salute you for what you did, because I have made it known that I agreed with you. I felt that the play of the story was sensational, irresponsible, and could have incited violence, and was not up to the standards of journalism as I understand them. I won't flog the listeners once again with my journalistic credentials, but I'm qualified to say that, and I truly believe that with all my heart. Now, Denise, why don't you pick up the story where Daniel left off? We've talked earlier in the summer. We talked about the Racine County Eye and your digital organization. Tell us now a little bit what's going to happen next, and we'll get back to dissecting this all a little bit more later. But why don't you continue the story from your vantage point on the other side of the county line?
Well, you know, I think one of the really important things to really note is that I used to work for the Kenosha News as well, as you guys know. And when we started covering the Jacob Blake story, there's a very big modus operandi that I use, and Daniel's starting to understand this about how I do business and also how I do journalism is that I want to always add value and institutional knowledge to any story that we write. And when the Jacob Blake story started emerging, when I was the second shift crime reporter, I spent a lot of time in Wilson Heights. So a lot of my former colleagues and people who know me professionally knew how much of a journalism addict I am. So when things started happening with Daniel, and it was probably about 20 minutes after you posted. I don't think we've ever talked about this, but about 20 minutes after he posted, I started getting by a ton of people saying, you should work with Daniel. He's your people. And I'm like, you know, I think one of the things that really struck me in just being professionally critical of kind of what the biggest issue was is that you have to, especially in situations that have a lot of emotion and violence, and you have to be very careful journalistically, not only just to make sure that you're covering the whole story and not the version of the story you want or support, but really making sure that you're operating with integrity and balance. And so when I saw what Daniel was doing, that's the thing that struck me the most of how he was operating, because he was very passionate about making sure that had happened. And, you know, it was interesting because all of my former colleagues, we all jumped in on this conversation about what should have happened. And so it's like that whole addict thing kind of was like, okay, so this is what needed to have happened. How do we make it, right? So how do we preserve the integrity of journalism, even in the midst of a lot of this crisis that was going on? And you saw a lot of that play out nationally in the narrative around racial disparity and how communities of color are struggling. And so what that looked like with the Jacob Blake shooting was that you had this narrative that wasn't completely accurate, because you know, you had a lot of video that was coming out, and we were watching it completely unfold under. I know I had my tweet deck open, and I was monitoring that stream, and had, you know, Corey's Corey's live stream and all of the other streams, and I was trying to take it in. But at some point, somebody's got to make meaning out of it and ask the really hard question of, am I seeing the whole story in context of beginning, middle, and end? And how do we make sure that the public understands what happened? And what happens sometimes in that spot news process, that we have to be the bastion of the truth. and in context, because you saw how all of that fragmentation happened depending on who believed what, you know, when you saw that Kyle Rittenhouse piece of that story, you know, you had a lot of people who were catching that one segment or that one photo in the middle of the story. When you had that video of the shooting, that was the middle of the story. And so journalists know that. And that's one of the things that we want to make sure that the Kenosha Lens and the Racine County Eye are always operating under that really strong voice of making sure that we have meaning and value to the reader.
And let me just add here that we are talking about Mr. Jacob Blake, and we want to take a minute to pause and share our feelings for him and for his family and hope that his recovery continues to go well. I do not have any late word on his condition. And by the way, we're recording, listeners, this on the Tuesday before broadcast. Now, Denise, what's going to be the relationship between the Racine County Eye and the work Daniel is doing? How is that? How does that fit together? I can go to your website now, and I have a drop down, a Daniel drop down. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. So the Kenosha Lens. So this is going to be a process, right? So we're in the process of defining what the Kenosha Lens is going to be, what the Uptown Observer is going to be. Daniel is Uptown Observer, and he is part of Kenosha Lens as well. So as of right this very moment, on Racine County Eye is a Kenosha Lens tab. If you pull that down, you'll see a lot of the different categories where Uptown Observer, you'll see all of the categories around government and things along that line. So that's really the relationship is that one of the things that I'm also super addicted to is making sure that local independent journalism is allowed to thrive. So Daniel is part of that overall mission of making sure that we're helping people, journalists, do the work that we need to be doing.
Daniel, as you've looking back now over the last 6 weeks and putting that in context with the whole picture of what's been going on in Kenosha, I have some thoughts about the overall reaction that you're having to where we are now with the committee work. You've done some of, coverage of those committees. What's your impression of what you've seen and heard there?
Okay, so Kenosha is a complicated place right now. It really is. I'll be completely honest. It's different than I've found it at any other period in my life. To me, it just feels different. You know, we have constant protests now, but at the same time, we have government trying to do things. But the thing that's interesting with Kenosha is that you have more people involved in the civic process as far as listening to meetings, attending meetings, calling into meetings, especially younger people, than you ever did. But you're also in a time period in Kenosha where you're seeing, I'm going to single out the county board. You had a county board member that refused to ever face the public while they spoke to her throughout an entire meeting. And after the meeting, you had several county board members that got into a fight with each other. This is all things happening in the public space, by the way. Anybody could see this. So you're watching leaders fighting with each other. You're watching infighting with protesters and counter-protesters. The thing you're not seeing in Kenosha is a community coming together and realizing that right now, We all need transparency. We need to be honest with each other. Don't tell me you're going to do something and then try to take over somebody's or remove their building or anything like that. It's that there's a lot of distrust in Kenosha. And I think that leaders are starting to, I mean, last night I listened to the city council meeting and they were talking about things, and Bugdala actually reopened a public hearing. They had two public comment periods on the cabaret license issue that we're not talking about today, but it points out, because the county board refused to do the same thing when it came to Mr. Rose's or Supervisor Rose's whole proposal on the aftermath of riots and race in the county. So council will people, but the county board will not reopen public comments for people. So you're seeing people are dealing with different leadership styles across the different bodies, but what they don't have is one person who is transparent, honest with them, and informative that they trust. Right now, you're seeing everybody in Kenosha kind of, the way that I think about it is you had all the national people come in and they did what they do, and everybody locally was mad at them because they're ruining our story. They leave. Now you're seeing people turn on each other because we have time for our frustrations with each other. So when it comes from the government level on down, you're seeing dysfunction. That's my opinion of Kenosha right now. And I'm not saying there aren't good people trying. What I'm saying is, in my opinion, I've seen in many ways leaders failing.
I think that's a very perceptive point. We're talking this morning on Community Matters with Denise Lockwood, publisher of the Racine County Eye, and joining her is Daniel Thompson of the Kenosha Lens and publisher of the Kenosha Uptown Observer. Denise, from way across the county line in Racine, how does it look to you as a professional observer? I doubt that you've been to these community meetings, but you've heard about them, you've been talking about them, and Racine's been is not unfamiliar with troubles of this sort around race, if we care to use that outmoded term. What's your thoughts?
Well, there's a lot of shared pain here, and when you look at Milwaukee being the worst place for Black people to live, Racine's number two place for Black people to live. There's a lot of shared failures in policy, and you've got some work to do that on that. So, you know, I see there's a lot of talk. There's a lot of feelings, and that's not really conducive to public policy. That's my biggest takeaway. When we get to a place where we're being painfully honest, I think one of the undertones policy-wise, and I'm going to beat this drum until the cows come home, like seriously, this is the hill I'll die on, right, is you've got to look at things like mental health access. You've got to look at how do we build professional mental health, you know, mental health professionals that are going to be able to deal with the trauma in these communities consistently and fairly. Because I can tell you, I've interviewed the person that runs the jail in Racine County, Bradley Friend, and he's basically saying to me, at no other point in my career, Denise, am I seeing more people with mental health issues coming in my jail. And not only that, that is completely dovetailing in with the fact that Kenosha County has no mental health hospital at all. Racine County went from 52 adult inpatient beds to 16. Milwaukee County's mental health complex, this is a huge regional issue. It's not only a mental health problem, it's a transportation problem, it's an employment problem, it's a housing problem, it's a childcare problem. And so when we look through the lens of racial disparity and injustice and oppression, we have to own that and not look back and really start to understand that we can have our feels all day long, but it doesn't make the truth go away. And so when I'm looking at it through the lens of reporting on things through United Way of Racine County's racial disparities, the data is so blatantly there And it is baffling to me how often I have written stories like this over the course of 20 years. It's frustrating. So, you know, I've done a 5-part series in Kenosha County on mental health access. I've done stories on Milwaukee County mental health access issues. It is not rocket science to understand where the problems are. It's actually owning the and here's where I think the undertone on this, go a little bit on this, is that we have a throwing people away problem. And we have this story we tell ourselves about how we should lock them up and throw away the key. And shockingly, this is what happens. This is not something that's going to go away. And if we stop throwing people away, we get people back. It is not rocket science. And it's baffling to me about how people talk about this problem. It's frustrating. As a journalist, it's frustrating. Daniel is nodding his head.
Did you want to comment, Daniel, before we go on?
No, I agree with Denise. I mean, it's funny because, you know,
it's a systems issue. It really is a systems issue.
The thing is, how far and how long we've been neglecting these issues and kicking the can down the road becomes so apparent when you start to realize just how many aspects of American life and even just life are ingrained with these inequities or these disparities. The difference in socioeconomics in Kenosha, it is, for one, it's always interesting to me to see where the people who look like me live. Both in Racine and Kenosha, it's in the poorest areas.
Yeah.
I'm reminded of the Kerner Commission report, which I think I may have quoted on an earlier program this year. The Kerner Commission in 1967, after the civil unrest following the deaths of Martin Luther King, the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King and other leaders, very tragic, that report was an excellent report and mainly left to rot on the shelf. And the observation that was made in that report was there were reports going back to the turn of the century, the turn of the last century, that had the same issues, the same conclusions, and nothing had been done. And a great scholar commented to the commission that reading all those past reports was like Alice in Wonderland. And one of the things that the report said that we must not do, it recommended all the things you would expect it would recommend, that we still hold forth and now have much better research to back up today than we did in 1967. They said we must not militarize the police. We must not militarize the police. What's your observation about the success of that recommendation of the Kerner Commission as we enter the official second decade of the 21st century, Daniel?
Well, let me just throw an example out there of where we are in the state of policing in Kenosha. So, night of the Blake shooting, I'm down at the shooting scene. Now, at the scene, only one deputy that was there put on riot gear, but that escalated things. Eventually, the police left that scene, but then protesters went to the public safety building downtown because they wanted to talk to a supervisor. So you have a crowd of people around waiting to talk to a supervisor. And meanwhile, by the way, this is what the police department does at night, or the sheriff's department, it's one of them. So many times there are people that show up outside of the public safety building at night looking to speak to a supervisor or something. And what will happen is that they'll see somebody, an officer, peek their head from around the corner and then shut off the lobby lights, never go to the door. Same thing happened that night, except when he walked around to the back door, this is where I first noticed them. So protesters out in the back talking about how we don't want violence, we just want to talk to a supervisor. If you looked in the doorway behind them, you'd see a line of deputies in riot gear, just standing there. You go around to the front about the same thing. Then out of nowhere, while people are still peaceful, still not doing anything, still just waiting for a supervisor, calling for a supervisor, you suddenly see a wall of riot police emerge on the side of the public safety building across the parking lot and start moving across the parking lot towards protesters, telling them to leave. In no point during any of that. And I was standing there while a protester was standing face-to-face with a deputy who was holding their pepper spray or their whatever they had in their hand to spray them, begging them almost not to do that here, not to make us another city like that. And he didn't, although I could see the struggle. And it was a black officer, too, so even I could even more tell the struggle that was going on inside of him. But at no point did any supervisor, did Sheriff Beth, did anybody that was in charge, because Sheriff Beth, once the emergency operator or the emergency command was activated, he is the emergency manager of the county. Automatically, Sheriff Beth would have been in charge of every response as far as law enforcement, as the emergency commander. All of it was David Beth's call. He chose to send out deputies in riot gear instead of sending out anybody trying to de-escalate. So do I think that if we've succeeded in not militarizing police? No. We have good police out there, don't get me wrong. But we have, as a country, historically, over years, decided that we want our police force to be a hammer instead of negotiators of peace. We want our police to be able to rush in and stop anything at a moment's notice, using anything necessary so that we can feel safe. But it doesn't make us any safer. It just means that we now have a police force that has military vehicles, riot gear, and equipment that they use on their own citizens when those citizens aren't on rest. It's not, it doesn't protect anybody. It's used against their citizens.
That's Denise, do you have any comment, Denise, on that topic of the militarization that the Kerner Commission predicted would be a response and that would they said would be the wrong response?
Well, I'm not familiar with the commission report, but what I can do is tell you, you know, being the crime reporter for off and on over the years in Kenosha, I remember doing a number of stories around the use of, you know, tasers, and that being the, you know, point where you could compel someone to take them into custody without pulling out a gun, and how being able to do that was a good thing. And not escalating that use of force and being able to have CIT, which is crisis intervention trained officers. And I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, Kenosha County and even Racine County has put a lot of effort into having CIT trained officers. What I do see is the use of force conversation. That's the middle of the story, right? And one of the things that I really want to caution people is there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. And when you're coming to that point of use of force, you're in the middle of the story. So when we see a lot of these videos of use of force, they are extremely violent, and we don't have context of which we can always understand depending on the slice of the video that we're seeing and the fragmentation of that story process. What I want to make sure when I'm looking at those lens through the lens of that story is making sure that we have that comprehensive understanding. And I also think that the story is much deeper in the fact that our police officers are also dealing with those system failures every single day with, you know, having, you know, a lot more homeless people, having people in crisis, having a lot more domestic violence, having a lot more mental health issues. That is soul sucking stuff. And we're putting our police officers in that position all of the time. So when you talk about safety, We have to talk about the beginning of the story, the middle of the story, and the end of the story. And if we don't have this really good comprehensive conversation of how do we make sure that we are not in a position where we have to use force? And I think there's starting to be that conversation. I see a lot more people being so much more defensive. You can't have a rational conversation about it. And that's really unfortunate.
Well, I'm going to turn us to another topic, but we'll come back to some of this serious stuff, too. But also serious, you know, when three journalists and some of the, you know, I interned with the Kenosha News a couple of summers. I did journalism. I have done radio reporting and journalism. Now I do civic affairs journalism. You get three journalists together, and if there's a presidential election going on, you know the topic's going to turn eventually to the presidential election and what's going on. We're recording this on Tuesday before broadcast, once again, listeners. But what's the buzz? Let me start with you, Denise. I mean, you both have broad circles of contact in the communities, and that's one of the fun things about talking with journalists is that because of their jobs, they talk to people of all stripes and all walks of life. It's their job. What are you hearing? What are you picking up about the political sense of the public in Racine?
Racine County as a whole is quite independent and purple. So, you know, you have that big old core of people who vote Democrat in the city, but the balance of the county is leans a red, but there's still a very strong purple kind of modality to it. And so I think when you look at who voted for Trump and who did not vote for Trump last year, or not last year, but the last presidential election, Trump won by 4%. You didn't have as many people of color that were at the voting polls. You didn't have as many younger voters from that 18 to 25 year old bracket. But one of the things that I am seeing is that there is a group of people that had voted for Trump who are not going to vote for Trump because of the civility and issues that and perceived, you know, errors in judgment and, you know, things along that line. I'm hearing a lot of especially in the context of COVID. What I do also see is that you had a lot of people of color who were really questioning whether Biden had the perception of what really needed to happen with mass incarceration because of a lot of the conversation of around who gets put in jail and who does not. And so you've got, you know, a really big quandary again.
Daniel, besides having a dirty ear, what did you learn?
Well, here's the thing is, okay, so I wasn't in Kenosha during the 2016 election. I was working in Indiana, which was an experience itself. So I didn't get to see or get the surprise, I guess, that maybe some people did with the last election locally. Because I even when I was here as a high school, I didn't pay much attention. But talking to people now, I've stopped trying to predict elections after 2016. I'm never doing it again. It's never happening. I'm never going to be like, oh, I think I know this. I don't know anything. You don't know anything. Who knows? Godzilla is going to be president. Anyway, so it's the thing that I've learned is that Republicans or Trump supporters, there is not a on-the-fence Trump supporter that I've ever met in Kenosha. I've never met somebody who's like, he's my guy. No, it's never been that. It's gung-ho, but on the funny thing that I've noticed is it's on issues, and it's clearly the Christian people are going to go towards the thing that could eventually overturn Roe v. Wade, and that's always been the case. But I hear a lot more from Trump voters than I hear from Biden voters. Or, I mean, let's face it, in Kenosha, the general thing that I felt after the primary was a sigh of like, after Bernie didn't get it, basically. Because you had a lot of people that were for Bernie. But honestly, looking at this election and thinking about it myself, nobody's excited about it. Is there one person really excited about not the election itself, but also what follows after? I mean, think about it. We have a president who's calling into question the peaceful transition of power, and that's just if he loses. Here's the thing, is I'm not even thinking, honestly, as a person at the election result, I'm just preparing for the aftermath of the election itself. Because from my point of view, talking to people around Kenosha or seeing everywhere, no matter what, the aftermath is going to be hell.
Let's talk a little bit about the new form of journalism that you're working in. It's not all that new. You know, we had newsreels in the movie theaters when I was a child, back when we were fighting the dinosaurs in the Lincoln Park Lagoon. Modern day video journalism with devices that are smaller than the palm of your hand and give high definition results is relatively new. Daniel Thompson, you're becoming suddenly. Video journalism has affected journalism in your lifetime, and I'm asking you the same question, Denise. In your lifetimes, how do you think video, the kind of video we can generate today, just like that, how do you think that's changed things? Daniel?
I think video always brings more awareness, because when you think about it, think about the shift between the patriotism that everybody felt during World War II, and then you have Vietnam, when you're starting to see what war looks like. So now that you're seeing more video utilization, let's say I utilize Facebook Live a lot and live platforms because to me it's the most objective you can get within reason. So people can see exactly what you were seeing from your perspective. You can't lie about anything you saw. So it keeps you honest, but also people know it's the truth. They're watching it with their own eyes. I've watched it almost overtake text news, because and I think it's going to happen over time, is that you're going to see a lot more of video reporting than you do see, let's say, long form writing or things like that, because we are just changing in how we're consuming stuff. I mean, it's we used to be satisfied with waking up in the morning and grabbing a paper and reading it while drinking coffee. Now we're only satisfied reading the news if we can do it on our phone while we're driving and we're 5 minutes late for work or something like that. It's just everything has to be more than one thing all the time.
Denise, what's your outlook?
I'm a little more kind of centrist but cynical a little. I think there's some problems depending on who's on the other side of the camera. When you are watching TV news, you're only getting that 1 minute, 2 minute blip. When you're on like a Facebook Live, and this happened on TweetDeck. I was up till probably 4 a.m. for several days watching my TweetDeck, and I was watching multiple streams, and it was so fragmented that I think the average news consumer really struggled with making sure that they were actually self-checking of what am I actually seeing here? And I think that is a real problem. And what I mentioned earlier, like when you saw the video of Jacob Blake being shot, again, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. And sometimes we don't get the end. And sometimes we don't get the middle. And quite frankly, when that video came out and everybody was like, oh, he was unarmed. And I said, how do we know that? You know, we weren't at ground level. We didn't see around that. And not to say that it is or is not that happened, but we don't know because of the angle of the way things are shot. So when that door opened, that meant the view between the police officer and where Jacob was sitting was not in our purview. And we forget that. We see him coming around that car, and he eventually did have a knife, but those are some of the things that really kind of come to my mind.
I would like to look ahead now a little bit and connect it to what we've all been talking about for the last nearly 45 minutes, folks. Daniel, with your new video journalism, Uptown Observer, working with the Kenosha Lens, what do you want to accomplish for our communities during the next 12 months? What's your aim?
I want to keep them informed, but I also want to, be able to show the community what it is. Because I, obviously, because I'm the observer, I see a lot of things in Kenosha, and not all of it I write about. But I've noticed all of it. And now that I kind of have the time and I have the different kind of perspective and really I'm dealing with a different kind of set of tools and everything like that, I want to be able to tell stories that I didn't tell before, that I didn't have time to tell before, or that I was too stuck covering the obligatory meetings or, you know, events to cover before. So I want to give the community something different, but something that it can actually see itself in. Much how, you know, some news sites try to mimic the look and feel of bigger sites, I want what I do to match the look and feel of the community and reevaluate that as time goes on. That's the Uptown Observer part. Kenosha Lens, it's very much building that, and much like me and Denise have talked about, it's the basically, with both, I'd like to make more of an impact locally. I have spent the past 6 weeks doing a lot of things nationally that have taken me away from my local work, and I'd like to spend the next year kind of getting back and digging into what I do best.
Well, you have a unique voice, Mr. Thompson, and I've listened to what you've had to say, and I've caught some of your music, and I have a feeling that we're going to be fascinated with the stories that you have yet to discover. We're going to be finding new ways to tell. Denise Lockwood from the Racine County Eye, what are you hoping to do for the community in the next 12 months?
So there's a reason why the tagline for the Kenosha Lens is journalism that serves. And that's really the nut graph, to use a newspaper term, of what we want to make sure that we're doing. And this is the conversation that Daniel and I are consistently having, as far as you don't have to be first. What you do have to do is produce better journalism that helps your reader. And when we do that, that forms really strong relationships. And this is absolutely what is needed in our industry. That's what I want to do.
You know, writing the first draft of history is what we say we do as journalists. I know you two have heard that before, and I think most of our listeners too do. What's the toughest thing for you writing the first draft of history, Denise?
Because I want to write it all, it's still always evolving. So I'm like, okay, at what moment do I stop and say, okay, I've got enough now? And this is a big struggle. Daniel and I already have had this conversation several times.
Well, at some point, you got to go with what you got, is what John Hohenberg taught us at the graduate school at Columbia University in New York City. That was, we even had a sweatshirt made up with that slogan, go with what you've got when the deadline comes. We're all in the deadline business. Daniel, you've got a lot of experience with the first draft of history and the crucible of here, literally. What's your take on what's the toughest part about that?
Okay, I'll give you one answer, and then I'll give you a more thoughtful answer. The thing about I always want to know how everything ends. So I'm always curious, working out in my mind, where things are going. And that's with, you know, policy, that's with meetings, that's with anything going on in the city. I sit there as people are talking, and I follow the logical steps of where it's going. So the hardest part for me is pulling myself back and reporting on the moment without my own input, without my own opinions about the outcome.
Thanks a lot. Thank you to my guests, Denise Lockwood, publisher of the Racine County Eye, and Daniel Thompson, publisher of the Kenosha Uptown Observer and with the Kenosha Lens. For Community Matters, this is